Hello and welcome to Killing Arden, episode 2. This is our continuing slow burn look at Arden of Faversham, and we're still in the first scene. The first scene is very long. We did not finish the first. I wasn't sure if we were going to finish the first scene last time, and we didn't. So we are, if you are following along with a script with line numbers, we are about to start on line 360. And the scene overall has over 600. So, yeah, we're almost a little over halfway through the first scene in real terms. And we will attempt to dance through some of the other scenes as well. But we're in no hurry. This is a slow burn, and we're primarily looking to see what adaptation or adjustments we might do for audio adaptation, but also just thinking about character and the shape of things, anything we might want to condense. We're always looking for audio to reduce the number of characters, just for the number of voices dancing about. But also, I say, looking ahead to stage production as well, because it is a reasonably well-known play, so the odds on it actually being a staged show are pretty high. They're pretty high. And joining me in this wonderful exploring room session thing is Alan, Eric, and Sarah. Everyone's waving, even though it's a podcast.
Hello. Hi. Hello.
Good evening.
And I'm your host, Robert Crichton. You must know who I am by now. I mean, every one of these things. I mean, you're sick to death of me by now. Anyway, so we left the first scene after a number of... It's a rolling scene. It keeps just moving on. You start off with this Arden being miserable and his mate Franklin saying, "Hi, it's okay, I've got some land for you. How's that?" And Arden says, "Ah, no, my wife... having an affair," and the other says, don't push it too much, mate, softly catchy monkey." And Arden just sort of accuses his wife and she denies it, and then you see her talking to Adam of the fleur-de-lis and you get some interior monologue and you find out no, she really does actually is actually having an affair and wants to murder her husband. And we slowly build up this terrible plan, this initial terrible plan that has been suggested. And there's a complicated series of people involved in the murder here. This is why I don't think this is a play that could ever really be broken up into episodes, maybe two episodes. But I think because of the sort of rolling nature of the plot, if you stepped away from it, you might lose the audience. So yeah, there's a terrible plan involving a painter. The painter just says, "Tell you what, why don't I give you some poison rather than do the terrible plan that you were talking about?" Another terrible plan's been instigated, which the painter complicates. It's all got very complicated. I want to say we're only 300 plus lines into the text. Alice has repeatedly been asked, Alice's, Arden's wife, has been repeatedly asked to go off and sort out breakfast, which she has done, having just bought poison from the painter. And that's where we're going to rejoin the scene. So I will ask Sarah to read Alice, Alan to read Arden, and Eric to read Mosby. Mosby is the would-be lover. Mosby has just done a great performative scene where he's been accused of being Arden's wife's lover, and he said, "No, I did love your wife, but I resisted. I didn't. I am so sorry. It is a thing in the past." And Arden goes, "Oh, it's all right then." Fair dues. You know, Franklin, who's also in the room, I will read Franklin. Franklin says, "Have you considered maybe disassociating yourself from this person?" No, I'm going to keep him even closer now," says Arden, because he's an idiot. Something odd going on there. So Mosby, having done this double bluff very, very effectively, here enters Alice, and I will read stage directions as we go.
"Husband, sit down. Your breakfast will be cold."
"Master Mosby, will you sit with us?"
"I cannot eat, but I'll sit for company."
"Sarah Michael, see our horse be ready."
"Husband, why pause ye? Why eat ye not?"
are not well. There's something in this broth that is not wholesome. Did Sal make it, Alice?
I did. And that's the cause it likes not you.
And she throws down the broth on the ground.
There's nothing that I can do to please your taste. You were best to say I would have poisoned you. I cannot speak or cast aside my eye, but he imagines I have stepped awry. Here's he that you cast in my teeth so oft. Now I will be convinced or purge myself. I charge thee, speak to this mistrustful man. Thou that would see me hang, thou, Mosby, thou. What favour hast thou had more than a kiss at coming or departing from the town?
You wrong yourself and me to cast these doubts. Your loving husband is not jealous.
Why, gentle Mistress Alice, cannot I be ill, but you'll accuse yourself? Franklin, thou hast a box of Mithridate. I'll take a little to prevent the worst.
Do so, and let us presently take horse. My life for yours, ye shall do well enough.
Give me a spoon. I'll eat of it myself. Would it were full poison to the brim, then should my cares and troubles have an end. Was ever silly woman so tormented?
Be patient, sweet love. I mistrust not thee.
God will revenge it, Arden, if thou dost. For never woman loved her husband better than I do thee.
I know it, sweet Alice. Cease to complain, lest that in tears I answer thee again.
Come, leave this dallying, and let us away.
Oh, forbear to wound me with that bitter word. Arden shall go to London in my arms.
Loath am I to depart, yet I must go.
Wilt thou to London, then, and leave me here? Oh, if thou love me, gentle Arden, stay. Yet, if thy business be of great import, go, if thou wilt. I'll bear it as I may, but write from London to me every week, nay, every day, and stay no longer there than thou must needs, lest that I die for sorrow.
I'll write unto thee every other tide, and so farewell, sweet Alice, till we meet next.
Farewell, husband, seeing you'll have it so, and Master Franklin, seeing you take him hence, in hope you'll hasten him home, I give you this.
And then she kisseth Franklin. And if he stay, the fault shall not be mine, Mosby. Farewell, and see you keep your oath.
I hope he's not jealous of me now.
No, Mosby, no. Hereafter think of me as of your dearest friend. And so, farewell.
And exeunt Arden, Franklin, and Michael, who's been standing about doing nothing. Pass the sick bag, Alice. it's so demoralizing, because it's like, actually, I mean, yes, in a sense you would quite like to poison him at this moment, but is actually to not properly poison him, is that sort of part of, I'm wondering if that's actually sort of the plan, because they turn it around so well to go, how dare you accuse me of poisoning you? I love you all the best. Oh, I you can't go to London. I will stay with you. Lovey, lovey, huggy, kissy. I mean, there's got to be so much sort of recording of fabric being touched and moving and you know, and the, sort of the physicality of that needs to sort of be got across on some way. But it's all so performative. I love the way Mosby just goes, I cannot eat, but I'll sit for company. I'll watch you eat the poison. and in a stage show, you can imagine there's a look of him just checking, have you poisoned it or straight away? Oh, no, I cannot eat, no. Lots of intimated business there as well. Arden obviously has to do at least one slurp. When he says, Sirrah Michael, see our horse be ready, slurp, then husband, wipe, maybe a cough, you know, that sort of thing. And then chair scraping back as he gets up, I am not well, that kind of stuff. And this is why, again, doing it on location feels very important, that if you do it literally with a kitchen table, you can, you know, you can get all of those noises to work and all of that to sort of fit together. Thoughts in the room. I've been talking a lot. Dara.
It's just making me wonder what sort of poison it is. This is not remotely relevant to recording it for audio, but it just, like, because it was a painter who gave her the poison, if it was something like turpentine, then that would literally be burning his mouth. You know, so you can imagine, as well as the sort of pushing back of the chair and a bit of coughing, he might actually be like, oh, oh, yeah. You know, there could be some, because for it to be such an instant effect, it's got to be something that he tastes in his mouth. Mm. And if it's depending on what the painter's given them, it could actually be like sort of burning. So you could maybe get a bit of that, I don't know, into the audio, but it's just making me think about what did the painter actually give her? What she put in there?
Well, there's a nice detail in the source material which isn't brought up here. It might turn up in some dialogue in a minute or something, but because of the sort of dramatization, this kind of detail has fallen away. But from the source, which we read a bit of last time, so there's the dweller who's had skill of poisons. She demanded to know if he was any good. He said yes. But she would have one made, as should be most vehement and speedy operation to dispatch the eater thereof. So she wants a fast-acting poison. She's requested it. That can I do, quoth he, and forthwith made her such a one and willed her to put it into the bottom of a porringer, and then after to pour milk to it, on it, which circumstance she forgetting did clean contrary, putting the milk in first and afterward the poison. So the point is that it's supposed to disguise the foul taste of the poison. So you're right, it's a foul tasting poison, but because she's made it wrong, I mean, the painter in this version didn't give her any user instructions to the poison, just said, ta-da, have a poison. So he, again, the source material, he, having received a spoonful or two of the milk, misliked the taste and colour thereof, and said to his wife, Mistress Alice, what milk have you given me here? Whereover she tilted it over her hand, saying, I can ween nothing to please you. So, he then took horse, rode to Canterbury, and by the way, fell into extreme purging upwards and downwards, and so escaped for that time. So the poison in the source material has an ongoing effect. It's reminding me of the Golden Age of crime fiction, you know, where, you know, a lot of poisonings are the plot, because there was a bit of a spate of poisonings in the late 19th, early 20th century, certainly in popular fiction. You know, arsenic poisoning, you know, taking a long time. You have to keep poisoning them and they get weaker and weaker and, you know, and stuff. But this is before the poisons book, I think. So you just get noxious substances from wherever you can. And a painter's quite a good person for that, because they deal with different chemicals as part of some of their painting. Sorry, again, I've talked a lot. Eric.
I was just going to mention where sort of Arden says, Sir Michael, see our horse be ready. Surely that would mean like he actually gets, like Michael, aka Franklin, I'm guessing, because they do leave, like, or whatever. Anyway, Michael leaves to get the horse. So you would sort of have the sound effect of someone leaving from the room.
Yes, something. The script doesn't indicate that he goes at that point, but you're right. There's perhaps an indication that Michael goes to go and then hears the sound of Arden and then comes running straight back or similar.
Oh, yeah.
There's all sorts of intimated suggestion there, but you're right, absolutely. It does say Sir Michael, see our horse be ready, but he might not immediately go and do it. It might be more make sure it's ready when I finish my breakfast, so it might not be, he might not need to do it straight away. Alan.
Yeah, I mean, we did have Michael introduced last time
with
I think it was plot number one, which was where he was being told by Alice, just make sure he doesn't come back. You know, dispose of him whichever way.
Yeah. And also, I forgot that the actual stage direction says Arden, Franklin, and Michael, so it's three different people.
Yeah.
But I say Michael could sort of exit and come back in or go to exit. You know, there's intimated stuff there. And I say, yes, this is murder plot number two, of course. This is the complication. The painter has been promised to sue, as has, you know, Michael as well. It was Michael, wasn't it? So there are these two murder plots going on already, of which Alice and Mosby are obviously very complicit because they're the commissioners. More plots will be available. But again, it's just so performative. And I do. And because you've got Franklin there and Michael, you know, these witnesses, I mean, you know, Arden doesn't know who's complicit in any of this. And, you know, Alice does this great bit of fawning, really, doesn't she? And Arden sort of buys it hook, like line and sinker, doesn't he? I mean, he seems to. I mean, he's in a much better mood the moment Mosby's made his confession. He's bought it, and Alice is able to sort of ride on the coattails of that. Sarah?
Yes, this goes back to what we were doing at the end of the last session, but I am wondering, has he bought it? Because just before Mosby did his mea culpa at the end of the last session and said, oh yes, I did fancy your wife, but nothing ever happened and I'm over it now. And he was like, oh good, okay. In that case, I trust you completely. Stay at home with my wife while I go off to London. That just seemed excessively trusting for a man who not only did he think he was sleeping with his wife, but also he said on several occasions that he really can't stand the man, regardless of that, because he's like a low, dirty, jumped up, you know, steward or whatever. I mean, he's really been very misogynistic and very unpleasant about misogynistic about his wife and unpleasant about this man. Mm. So I am wondering if actually all of this is performative. Like, she is performing, she thinks she is performing to him, but he is actually performing to her as well. I'm not entirely convinced that he's bought this yet. And maybe I'm overthinking it, and maybe the plot will the way it unravels, it will sort of show that he is completely clueless, in which case he is exceedingly clueless and seems to have undergone something of a personality change in the way that he's now, the way that he seems to just now really trust and also like Mosby, because it wasn't just that he was sleeping with his wife. He had all sorts of other class issues with him earlier as well.
Mm. Well, maybe having basically put him in his place, which he was. I mean, it was an incredibly cruel scene that we closed the last session with, where he and Franklin basically turn on him in a really quite unpleasant way. Maybe now they've had their fun and they think they've put him in his place, that actually shifts that relationship in Arden's mind. Maybe Arden just goes from these extremes. You know, he's been brooding by himself all morning since he got out of bed, having heard his wife whisper, "Mosby." That, you know, Franklin's arrived and then they've had the talk and actually everything's fine and it's all in his head and he's been convinced. I think this is one of those things where, you know, the actor needs to make a decision and actually you just ride to that, because I don't think the play ever gives us a proper answer to that. I don't think the play has a thesis on Arden's interiority in the same way as Alice, for example. But I might be wrong on that point. We shall see. That's the point of doing this. What else? Did I have anything else to throw into the bag before anyone else throws? There was something. There was something. There was something else. But it will have to wait, because I can't think what the hell it was. So let's go on. They've all exited. I love the kiss of Franklin. I thought that was very nicely played by Alice there, of just going, you know, oh, she will chastely kiss someone, you know, because maybe that puts thoughts into Arden's head again, in a different direction, to throw the scent, you know, if can't trust anyone. Sarah?
Yeah, well, also, she said earlier when she was protesting, you know, she turns on Mosby at one point, and says, oh, you know, this is all your fault because, you know, you've had no favours from me more than a kiss at coming or departing from the town. That's all you've had from me. You know, stop freaking out about it and stop making my husband jealous. And of course, so then she kisses Franklin in front of her husband, Franklin, who is her husband's best friend, in this very chaste way. And it's like, yeah, this is what Mosby's had from me. It's like a sort of little reminder. Yes, I do this to everybody, all my husband's friends, all of his companions. So it's just this little added extra performative thing, I think.
I've got a note in the script from last time, actually. Maybe Alice should just go around the room and kiss everybody very pointedly after doing Franklin. Eric?
Well, it's also kind of that thing, I wasn't here for the previous session, but I scrolled up a bit and like Mosby actually says, who lives that is not touched with slanderous tongues? So it's kind of like she's, you know, playing off of that sort of incriminating somebody else as well, possibly. Mm.
I think in a stage production, I'd also be quite tempted to have Alice listening at the door for a bit of the Mosby scene before. Because if she's overheard what's gone on, what she then does is quite telling. To refer to, I've never shown him any, you know, that kind of stuff might feed off actually what Mosby's just done in his performance. So, yeah, there's interesting stuff. Okay, we have another short unit of action that sort of ties off the end of this little sequence. So Arden, Franklin and Michael have all left, leaving Alice and Mosby alone.
I am glad he is gone. He was about to stay. But did you mark me then how I break it off?
Aye, Alice, and it was cunningly performed. But what a villain is that painter Clark?
Was it not a goodly poison that he gave? Why, he's as well now as he was before. It should have been some fine confection that might have given the broth some dainty taste. This powder was too gross and populous.
But had he eaten but three spoonfuls more, then had he died and our love continued.
Why, so it shall, Mosby, albeit he live.
It is impossible, for I have sworn never hereafter to solicit thee, or, whilst he lives, once more importune thee.
Thou shalt not need. I will importune thee. What, shall an oath make thee forsake my love? As if I have not sworn as much myself and given my hand unto him in the church. Hush, Mosby. Those are words, and words is wind, and wind is mutable. Then I conclude 'tis childishness to stand upon an oath.
Well proved, Mistress Alice, yet by your leave, I'll keep mine unbroken whilst he lives.
Aye, do. And spare not, his time is but short. For if thou be'st as resolute as I, we'll have him murdered as he walks the streets. In London, many alehouse ruffians keep, which, as I hear, will murder men for gold. They shall be soundly feed to pay him home.
Here enters Green.
Alice, what's he that comes yonder? Knowest thou him?
Oh, Mosby, be gone. I hope 'tis one that comes to put in practice our intended drifts.
Murderer number three, please. So, we've got... There's nice things in here. Again, we're following on from the theme earlier of Mosby saying, I'm not going to push this, you know, at the moment. Because, you know, he initially came in saying, I'm breaking off with you. This has got to stop. Whilst he lives, I'm not going to solicit you anymore, and you know, I will not importune thee. And Alice is going, no, I'm quite keen to importune thee. Thank you very much. And repeats and sort of develops the thought from earlier. You know, oaths are words, and words is wind. There's some really. I mean, and for the time, that's a very, very dangerous concept. Actually, that oaths. Don't really have any meaning. It's something that will become very important after the gunpowder plot in a little over 10 years' time. It's something which is partly also down to issues to differences between Protestantism and Catholicism. It's also the kind of issues that are going to be undermined by sort of oncoming capitalism. Whereas before, oaths had weight. Oaths were important. This is why swearing of the time was all about oaths. So if you swore by something, that's supposed to have weight. So if you're doing it flippantly, that's undermining the entire basis of your legal system. Whereas scatological stuff is not as important in swearing. It will become so later on. But at this time, that's what's considered shocking. It's radical stuff for these people to be talking about. We don't have this idea that Arden's going to be feeling sick after this. You know, he's only had one spoonful, but he's going to be okay. The idea that the poison didn't taste good enough, they didn't get the nice tasting poison. I hate to point out, Alison Mosby, there aren't that many nice tasting poisons. By the nature of poisons, they all taste horrible because our bodies are trained to distrust things that poison us. So we're actually quite good at detecting poisons in many ways. Eric.
I'm just wondering, because Alice goes, as if I've not sworn as much myself and given my hand unto him in the church. It made me wonder how long she's been married to Arden and how long she's been trying to have the affair with Mosby. Because if it happened in parallel, then obviously it changes things. Like, sort of, if she married him and also had the affair with Arden at the same time, Mosby at the same time, it changes the dynamic of that relationship, kind of.
Yeah. How long have they been married? We've discussed already previously the age difference. We think there probably is one, which is something that's there. And also, are there any children? Have we heard mention any children? I don't think there are any children. So that's an interesting question about what's going on here. Alan.
Yeah, I think when in discussion last time, we were actually wondering whether she was actually a sort of trophy wife, you know, someone in her 20s, whereas Arden could be in his 50s.
Again, that's a bit of a modern concept in the sense that, you know, a landed person, you know, would possibly, you know, people got through a lot of wives and husbands generally, and age differences could occur quite a lot. The idea of being a trophy, I think, is to say, a bit modern in that sense. But I could be wrong on that point. Sarah?
Yeah, I just, following on from a couple of things that you said, do we know from the source material how long they've been married?
I don't think it mentions it. I do not recall it. I will rapidly scan. But I don't think there is that kind of detail. Arden was a tall man. There is nothing that I immediately see, but I will keep scanning.
I mean, yeah, and it might crop up in the play as a sort of, you know, someone might make a passing reference to it. But it just occurs to me, if they haven't been married that long, you know, because the fact that there's no evidence as yet anyway that there are any children, that does put a slightly different complexion on it as well, because they might literally have only been married a few months, in which case
I have found something that will give us a sense of dating. So after it does seem that Mosby oftentimes lay in Arden's house, in so much that within 2 years after he obtained such favour at her hands that he lay with her. So
right,
there are years of passing. And that's not saying in the real life there weren't children, or there wasn't, you know, that this wasn't, you know, this is a stage depiction, therefore. Older grizzled character actor and a young ingenue is even today is not an unusual casting choice. if it was made in the 50s, that's exactly how I see it. It's that kind of thing.
Well, it just, because it would tie into the what you were saying about the oaths thing as well. If those oaths are relatively recent, it kind of makes it even more shocking for the contemporary audience. And I'm thinking about this in relation to it being a true crime drama. You know, the thing that would thrill a modern day audience listening, who were listening to a true crime podcast, which would be, I don't know, probably some like gory details of some terrible, heinous murder plot or whatever. The kind of thing that would have thrilled the audience back then to their core probably would have been this oath breaking, the fact that the author makes such a thing of it. And if they haven't actually been married that long, that makes it even more shocking in a way. So it's just, it heightens the drama.
Mm. And there is that sort of thing in terms of taking a, you know, by this point, a relatively old true crime story. You know, it's 40 years ago that the actual crime was committed. It's not like it's a straight out of the tabloid, it happened, you know, a couple of years ago type thing. You know, everybody's dead pretty much by now, anyone who's involved in this case. So it's not, it has a different sort of feel in that sense. But yes, how shocking these things are. I mean, again, by the 1590s, maybe the shock value in oaths is already diminishing anyway. I'm not 100% certain how far that has gone. Eric?
I'm also wondering, sort of, because she seems to be quite organized about the way she's thinking about this. Like, okay, so the poison didn't work, therefore the next part is the, you know, get him killed in London. And like, I mean, obviously time is passing in terms of years, maybe, I don't know, given like sort of the real nature of the crime. But then it seems so much more calculated in this play, sort of like, yeah, that didn't work. So, you know, next idea, then next one, sort of, she already knows that he's going to go to London at some point. And then it's like she already made the contacts to sort of have him murdered there. Because Mosby has not met Green, who's coming in.
Mm. Sarah?
Yeah, and following on from what Eric was just saying there, like, I wonder for audio whether you'd want to actually have some sort of indication of the passing of time, because I can see why this has all been condensed for the purposes of putting it on stage. But the fact is, you know, Green, she says at the end there, this is one who will put into practice our intended drifts, i.e. will have him murdered as he walks the streets of London. It kind of turns it a bit farcical, because if she'd really already set up this meeting with Green, then that must have been like, well, I guess the poison isn't going to work, so therefore I'll have this as a backup plan. It's like she's almost assuming that her murderous plots aren't going to be very good. So she's already got a backup plan, which, I don't know, makes it slightly absurd, which I am not against. But I wonder if you want to have like a, after she says they shall be soundly feed to pay him home, maybe you wanted to put in there something like have them kissing maybe, and then it kind of going into some kind of, I don't know, noise foley to suggest the passing of time maybe before Green appears. I don't know.
I mean, it's interesting because if it was in front of a live audience, we really wouldn't, I don't think we'd even try to avoid the black comedy aspect of it all. It's an interesting question for tone without a live audience, how much you play that, on how much you can play that. You know, we know from on the podcast earlier in the podcast stream, you will have heard, or you may have heard the interview I did with Beth Burns of Hidden Room Theatre and their production of Arden, which, you know, the audience are laughing throughout. I mean, it's a comedy. It's explicitly a comedy, or it can be moved in that way. Obviously, it all gets less funny when the actual murder takes place. Spoilers. He's been dead for part of 500 years. Get over it. There is that element. I suspect it's a middle ground a bit with audio. I think we possibly just let it play out. I think you're right. I like the idea of them embracing or any of that kind of stuff. I don't mind it being a bit sexy. I think that's perfectly allowed. Whether we need a time gap, I'm not so sure. But that's one you could sort out in the edit anyway. We have the entrance of Green. It isn't easy. So let's see how it goes. So Mosby exits. Alan, if you could be Green, please.
Yes, sir. It's not easy.
No, it's not easy.
Mr. Arden, you're well met. I'm sorry that your husband is from home, when as my purpose journey was to him. Yet all my labour is not spent in vain. I suppose that you can full discourse and flat resolve me of the thing I seek.
What is it, Master Green? If that I may, or can with safety, I will answer you.
I heard your husband hath the grant of late, confirmed by letters patents from the king, of all the lands of the Abbey of Faversham, generally entitled, so that all former grants are cut off, whereof I myself had one. But now my interest by that is void. This is all. Mistress Arden, is it true or no?
True, Master Green. The lands are his in state, and whatsoever leases were before are void for term of Master Arden's life. He hath the grant under the Chancery seal.
Pardon me, Mistress Arden. I must speak, for I'm touched. Your husband doth me wrong to wring from me the little land I have. My living is my life. And only that resteth remainder of my portion. Desire of wealth is endless in his mind, and he is greedy, gasping still for gain. Nor cares he, though young gentlemen do beg, so he may scrape and hoard up in his pouch. But seeing he hath ta'en my lands, I'll value life as careless as he is careful for to get. And tell him this from me, I'll be revenged. And so, as he shall wish the abbey lands had rested still within their former state.
Alas, poor gentleman, I pity you. And woe is me that any man should want. God knows, 'tis not my fault. But wonder not, though he be hard to others, when to me, oh, Master Green, God knows how I am used.
Why, Mistress Arden, can the crabbed churl use you unkindly? Respects he not your birth, your honourable friends, nor what you brought? Why, Kent knows your parentage and what you are.
Master Green, be it spoken in secret here. I never live good day with him alone. When he's at home, then I have froward looks, hard words, and blows to mend the match withal. And though I might content as good a man, yet he doth keep in every corner trolls. And when he's weary with his rugs at home, rides he straight to London. There, forsooth, he revels it among such filthy ones as counsel him to make away his wife. Thus live I daily in continual fear, sorrow, so despairing of redress as every day I wish with hearty prayer that he or I were taken forth the world.
Now, trust me, Mistress Alice, it grieveth me so fair a creature should be so abused. Why, who would have thought the civil sir so sullen? He looks so smoothly. Now, fire upon him, churl, and if he live a day, he lives too long. I shall be the man shall set you free from all this discontent. And if the churl deny my interest and will not yield my lease into my hand, I'll pay him home, whatever hap to me.
But speak you as you think?
Aye, God's my witness. I mean plain dealing. I'd rather die than lose my land.
Oh, then, Master Green, be counselled by me. Endanger not yourself for such a churl, but hire some cutter for to cut him short. And here's £10 to wager them withal. When he is dead, you shall have 20 more. And the lands whereof my husband's is possessed shall be entitled as they were before.
Will you keep promise with me?
Or count me false and perjured whilst I live.
Then here's my hand. I'll have him so dispatched. I'll up to London straight, I'll to the post, and never rest till I have compassed it. Till then, farewell.
Good fortune follow all your forward thoughts.
And an interesting question, whether Green actually exits at that point or whether at the end of the next two lines. I am unsure. I was sure in a previous existence, and then I looked at it again and go, no, maybe you can play that actually as part of the aside. Anyway, Alice just really knows how to manipulate people. It's brilliant, isn't it? It's woe is me. Oh, he's so horrible to me. Mm. And it's basically just leading Green to, you know, be my white knight, save me, and you get your lands. But it's the save me quality of that. I really like it. It's playing into that sort of that delusion that you can be the savior of the woman who is in peril. That he can write it plays into that so well. I this is so beautifully packed together, especially as this, in plotting terms, this is again returning to the opening lines of the play. You know, all of these plotting details are all threaded through. This isn't come out as some random surprise of going, hang on, what? We've had this brought up several times across the scene. We're still in scene one, even though it's made up of all these little units. It is wonderfully structured. Sarah?
Yes, and I just do love... I mean, obviously, this was written for stage, and so it would have been obvious to the audience, but from the purposes of audio, it's all there already. I do love that little throwaway line that... Green has when he says, and he is greedy, gaping still for gain, nor cares he though young gentlemen do beg. So it's just kind of thrown in there that he's a, you know, Green is a young gentleman. And that makes such a difference, because the fact that she is playing, Alice is sort of playing to his knight errantry instincts. You know, if he's quite a young guy and she's there like, you know, he beats me, and you know she's deliberately working on his chivalric instincts that perhaps wouldn't necessarily work quite so well on an older man, but because he's young, she knows exactly how to play him.
Green is a bit green. I mean, it's the clue is in the name. And yeah, absolutely. You can almost imagine that he's the one at home reading romance novels. In fact, the kind of romances that Green actually wrote. So it's Eric.
Or just like the books, like from, you know, The Knight and Burning Pestle. I was going to mention the line where Green goes, will you keep promise with me? And then Alice goes, or count me false and perjured whilst I live. I imagine in a live production, like a staged production, you would see that as a, like a sort of wink, wink to the audience, because she's already said that oaths and words and that are just wind. It doesn't matter. And she's already perjured herself, technically.
We will do our best. just scout's honor, governor. Scout's honor.
Like fingers crossed. It was just an interesting scene.
Again, it's another really interesting one. Okay, we are into the last gasp of scene one. It's nearly over, people. I was getting to the point where I was going, are we actually going to finish scene one this session? We will. It's fine. Again, very little here that I'm worried about. I think getting a sense of a room that people are travelling through, and that it all sort of it all feels very singular location. It's, it works well. So Green has exited, and Alice, I say it might be the Green exits after the next two lines that come. There's a dash in the script that we have suggesting that. That's not necessarily original by any stretch of the imagination. And this, it feels like his, and so farewell is his exit, but it could be that this is more a bye, Mark, who I'm going to dispense with later on, kind of line. So I'll have a think about that, Sarah, as you say it. Eric, remain as Mosby, who's about to enter, and Alan, if you could be Clark.
Sure.
Exit Green.
Good fortune follow all your forward thoughts. And whosoever doth attempt the deed, a happy hand I wish. And so farewell. All this goes well. Mosby, I long for thee, to let thee know that all I have contrived.
Here enter Mosby and Clark.
How now, Alice? What's the news?
Such as will content thee well, sweetheart.
Well, let them pass a while and tell me, Alice. How have you dealt and tempered with my sister? What, will she have my neighbour Clark or no?
What, Master Mosby? Let him woo himself. Think you that maids look not for fair words? Go to her, Clark. She's all alone within. Michael, my man, is clean out of her books.
I thank you, Mistress Arden. I will in. And if fair Susan and I can make agree, you shall command me to the uttermost, as far that either goods or life may stretch.
Exit Clark.
Now, Alice, let's hear thy news.
They be so good that I must laugh for joy before I can begin to tell my tale.
Let's hear them that I may laugh for company.
This morning, Master Green, Dick Green, I mean, from whom my husband had the abbey land, came hither, railing for to know the truth whether my husband had the lands by grant. I told him all. Whereat he stormed amain and swore he would cry quittance with the churl, and, if he did deny his interest, stab him whatsoever did befall himself. When, as I saw his collar thus to rise, I whetted on the gentleman with words, and, to conclude, Mosby, at last we grew to composition for my husband's death. I gave him £10 for to hire knaves by some device to make away the churl. When he is dead, he should have 20 more and repossess his former lands again. On this we agreed, and he is ridden straight to London for to bring his death about.
But call you this good news?
Hi, sweetheart. Be they not?
What cheerful news to hear the churl were dead. But trust me, Alice, I take it passing ill you would be so forgetful of our state to make recount of it to every groom. What, to acquaint each stranger with our drifts, chiefly in case of murder? Why, 'tis the way to make it open unto Arden's self and bring myself and me to ruin both. Forewarned, forearmed, who threats his enemy lends him a sword to guard himself withal.
I did it for the best.
Well, seeing 'tis done, truly let it pass. You know this Green. Is he not religious? A man, I guess, of great devotion.
He is.
Then, sweet Alice, let it pass. I have a drift, will quiet all, whatever is amiss.
I just want to pause it. What I love about this little sequence is that Mosby basically goes, stop telling everyone that we're trying to murder your husband. This is the third person we've brought in. And you know, I also really like the way they play Clark as well. Because, you know, come in. Have you got some news? I've got some lovely news, but let's not talk in front of Clark. Let's not go too much into that. And then he's going, you know, will it have my sister? And it's just going, woo yourself. You know, it's not actually our job to do that part. You know, we'll clear the ground, but, you know, go off, bugger off, do some wooing. And I just love the way that Mosby goes, well, it'd be great if you told me he was dead. But you've now told me there's someone else trying to murder him now. God, it would be a pile up. You've never seen a murderer on the Orient Express. Sarah.
Yeah, I'm also thinking there's a farce developing behind the scenes here, because we've now had, like, Susan's been effectively pimped out by her own brother or her brother's paramour to three different people. First of all, it was Michael, then it was the painter, and now it's Clark. And I'm thinking, this poor girl.
Clark is the painter, isn't it?
Oh, is he the painter?
Yes, Clark is the painter.
Oh, yeah, so it's only two. It's only two. So that's fine.
Right, okay. That's fine then, if it's only two. Because I was thinking there's just going to be a pileup of lovers in the kitchen as well. Everyone, they go to see Susan. It's like, oh, I've been promised to you, Susan. And, oh, well,
I'm surprised Green wasn't offered, to be honest. You know, would you like lands and a wife? We've got a bog off offer.
I think, though, that... that Alice was fluttering her eyelashes at Green, wasn't she? I mean, in that final speech she had to him, where she was like, oh yes, and I'll make sure the lands all come to you. I think that could definitely be played with a sort of, and you get a free wife into the bargain, you know, maybe. I don't know. But okay, that's good. So, okay, Susan's only been promised to two different people. Well, this makes life so much better.
Yeah. It's not problematic in any way, shape or form. But I think what this little bit of this text really speaks to is that difficulty that dramatists have when they're taking a pre-existing story, true or otherwise, and trying to make it into a plausible stage story. Because, I mean, it's more of a problem when it's just, you know, a romance narrative or some mythic tale, because people just do things for no readily apparent reason, and you're just trying to square the circle of give a character a motivation to do something. There is an element with so much true crime where you're sitting there going, why would you, that's just dumb, why did you do that? And it, you know, it turns out that most true crime we know about, it's because the criminals were really rubbish at what they did, and they get caught really quickly, and, you know, it's all really obvious. And this is sort of talking to that. Mosby is actually going, this is a terrible way to plan a murder. Stop telling everyone. And so it's a bit of lampshading, really, to sort of just get us over the hump, perhaps, of feeling, I can't believe this is true, that I quite like. Eric?
Still, I feel like Mosby is kind of equally stupid in that department, if that makes sense. Kind of, he kind of goes, I take it, Pastor Gill, you would be so forgetful. You know, he has the big sort of speech about that, and then sort of goes, let it pass. I'll sort it out later, kind of thing. Which, yeah, seems a bit sort of like loose ends that will come back to bite you later, kind of thing.
I mean, if I was Mosby and I was planning to murder her husband in any way, I would just not be about the house as much as, but I would just try to disassociate myself from the wife for as long as possible, because it's clearly a terrible idea. Anyway, they didn't have murder mysteries in those days, so you know, it's. They're not as experienced. I think we're putting in the chat this question of, you know, we seem to be remarkably well versed in questions of what to do with in case of murders, how to plan them, how to organise them, how to get rid of the body, and it is. It's just we are weirdly steeped in all of the mechanics of death, in a very weird way. So, and that's not just us. That's our culture. Let's just be clear. Anyway, we should move on. More death. So Clark, having been told to go and pimp for yourself, returns with Susan. So, Alan, as you were for Clark, I will read Susan.
How now, Clark? Have you found me false? Did I not plead the matter hard for you?
You did.
And what? Will it be a match?
A match, your faith. Aye, the day is mine. The painter lays his colours to the light. His pencil draws no shadows in his love. Susan is mine.
You make her blush.
What, sister, is it? Clark must be the man.
It resteth in your grant. Some words are past, and haply we be grown into a match, if you be willing that it shall be so.
Ah, Master Clark, it resteth at my grant. You see my sisters yet at my dispose. But so you'll grant me one thing I shall ask. I am content my sister shall be yours.
What is it, Master Mosby?
I do remember once, in secret talk, you told me how you could compound by art a crucifix empoisoned, that whoso look upon it should wax blind, and with the scent be stifled, that ere long he should die poisoned that did view it well. I would have you make me such a crucifix, and then I'll grant my sister it shall be yours.
So I'm loath, because it touches life. Yet rather or I'll leave sweet Susan's love. I'll do it, and with all the haste I may. But for whom is it?
Leave that to us. My clerk, is it possible that you should paint and draw it out yourself, the colours being baneful and empoisoned, and no ways prejudice yourself withal?
Well questioned, Alice. Clark, how answer you that?
Very easily. I'll tell you straight how I do work with these empoisoned drugs. I fasten on my spectacles so close as nothing can in any way offend my sight. Then, as I put a leaf within my nose, so I put rhubarb to avoid the smell, and softly, as another work, I paint.
'Tis very well. But against when shall I have it?
Within this next 10 days.
'Twill serve the turn. Now, Alice, let's in and see what cheer you keep. I hope now Master Arden is from home, you'll give me leave to play your husband's part.
Mosby, you know who's master of my heart. He may well be the master of the house.
And exit. So we have the return of the poison, magic poison crucifix plot from earlier. So the painter Clark, because we always want to think of him as a clerk, but he's not. Clark is a painter. And yeah, so we return to this. Having failed to use the poison just to poison him, they're going back to this. As I say, I don't think this is in the source material at all. It might have been later on in the source material that this plotline came up, because I hadn't read further on again. I have read this before, the source material before, but I don't recall that being a thing. And the painter is, I don't know if he's given a name yet. He definitely had a different name in real life. I'm fairly certain. So, yeah, so once again, the logistics. I love that, the rhubarb to avoid the smell. You know, which is a... Rhubarb had many medicinal uses, so that's obviously one of them. Obviously, it's mostly used to purge. And that sort of slightly, you know, you'll give me leave to play your husband's part. I mean, shall we get it on, dear? Again, in front of witnesses, how explicit were they with who was here last time? How explicit was Clark and Arden about what the poison was for? Did they actually state clearly that they wanted it? Yes, they did.
No, I thought they did. Yeah.
Yes, they absolutely did. So, in a sense, this isn't an additional murder plot, or at least they haven't brought a new person in. But it does. Mm. It's that thing. But then, in a sense, this has closed off Michael, of course, because now we have a sort of official engagement going on here. So Michael, who thought he was going to get Susan, this slightly bars his thing. Other thoughts about this scene, Alan?
Looking at the scene overall, it seemed a bit weird because it doesn't follow either of the dramatic unities, because there's changes of location within it, and there's also, fairly obviously, there must be some time jumps. It's not continuous action.
I don't know about time jumps. I think it's got to be continuous action because the stage is never empty. I don't think there's any reason why the time shifts. I mean, you're absolutely right. There is that weird bit where they seem to have been walking somewhere. But even that, I mean, I think we pretty much decided we're just going to make it. They look out the window and see the person walking along rather than they're walking out. But apart from that, I don't see a temporal disunity. Unless you've found something. I mean, it is condensing action.
It all feels very, very condensed, and difficult to sequence without people almost colliding with one another on the way in and out of the doors?
I think there's definitely a lot of motion, but there's always someone left behind on stage to be met, and then there's a little... This is why Alice keeps having these little soliloquies or little moments with Mosby. They're little moments with Mosby to prepare the next people to come, you know, whoever's just left and whoever's coming back in again. There's a question with this scene as to what to do about Susan. Susan does reappear and does get some occasional dialogue, but Susan is not a impactful character. I mean, there are some scenes later on where her presence is very important, but I don't think in terms of hearing her voice, the impact. So there's a question in my mind of who do we double Susan with, because that's got to happen, and how extreme we go for that. Because the more extreme a voice you go for, the voice shift you go for, the better.
You could double her with Michael, perhaps.
I don't want to double with anyone within this scene. So it's any characters who now appear going forward. I would be happy. But, I mean, there are some options. I know I've got options for Susan. But Susan is a disappointing... On stage, of course, I'd probably physically pad the part out a bit, as well as doubling. It's just a matter of who is the best double for Susan in terms of voice, in making sure it sounds distinctly different. But luckily, as I say, I don't think there are that many additional female characters, so it can be played across gender in interesting ways. Eric.
I'm just wondering about Mosby's sort of turn from, like, you know, sort of I won't touch you till we kill him to give me leave to play your husband's part. Because like he does the second one, like he goes, you know, you'll give me leave to play your husband's part in front of witnesses, as you said. Whereas the other one seems to be when they're alone. Which is quite, makes me wonder if he's expecting someone to be listening in.
Yeah. Well, I suppose if we got Clippy Cloppy Horses, you know, after Arden's left, you know, they feel a bit more secure now. But you're right, there is a Mosby flip flops a lot. So I think there's some work there the actor has to do in terms of building that journey or building a character who just flip flops a lot, at this particular moment is high on the idea of the poisoned crucifix, and maybe he's getting off on that a bit, and that's got him in the mood. I don't know what turns Mosby on. Maybe it's murder. Maybe it's murder. For
just
some...
Alice flirting with him continually.
Well, Alice plotting a murder seems to be how she flirts. I don't know. That could be grossly unfair on poor Alice. I mean, you know, it's not necessarily a particularly fair depiction of a human being, but it is a very enjoyable one, that possibly just makes us a very bad person. Other thoughts before we move on to scene two? Alan?
Yeah, I think we could probably, or something could probably be done within the audio environment. I think we basically discussed Franklin and Arden played as fairly posh. Mosby as semi-posh, maybe Green similarly. Michael, Susan, as not quite rustic, but more rural accents.
Green because he has you know, potential attachment to land suggests that he might be slightly further up the social scale. I mean, he's young. That's why he's, you know, behind the curve. So I think that might be a way to go with that. Green, I have literally nothing helpful on. I'm just flicking through to see if I've got any additional notes anywhere on Green. It's a tricky part in many ways. Okay, let's move on to scene. Sarah, then Eric.
No, I've just been mulling over the whole temporal thing. I think it's something that does need sorting out, moving on from what Alan was saying about it a minute ago, because thinking about it, for doing this for audio, you've got to decide what you're going to do with it, I think, because you've either got to put some kind of and given what Eric was saying about Mosby as well, like changing his tune, that would make more sense if you put in some sense of time passing through this scene. If you wanted to do it as a true crime type podcast, I think you'd need to do that. Or if you're going to do it, play up the farcical side of it and do it as a comedy, then basically, because basically all of this has otherwise happened in the course of one morning. You know, Alice has had a really busy morning. She's had three murder plots.
But this is the thing. So much of it is linked to its time all happening in one morning. Is, you know,
yeah.
It's Arden's been up all night. He's keeps asking for breakfast. Breakfast is delivered. He then leaves. It's all time coded. There is no real, apart from maybe those last two sequences that we've just done, which are very short. There's no way to break it because it is all it's all time coded. It's all set in one time. I genuinely don't. I mean, I entirely agree that, you know, the original source material, all of this stuff happened, you know, over a much greater period of time. But the way this play is written, it's so tightly written as well. I don't think I'd want to unravel it because I think you'd lose that momentum. That's why I was sort of saying I don't want to pull it into parts because you'd forget who everyone is.
I did.
It's quite fiddly.
I forgot who the painter was.
Yeah. We've had a week since we last looked at this and, you know, already the mind grows dim. Eric.
I was just going to say that it's interesting how he brings Clark in with, like, blackmail. Not blackmail, but sort of manipulation. It's basically what Alice did to Green. And kind of Mosby's, I'm just intrigued by sort of the sound effects you could get out of this scene, sort of, oh yes, Grom is such a crucifix and all that stuff. And then like that chat with Clark feels like he's kind of taking him aside, so you could maybe sort of briefly pan the sound, so to speak, like, oh yes, we'll have a chat over here, but then Alice intervenes. I don't know, it just feels a bit sort of in private, especially even like in front of Susan. It's kind of weird to have that chat like so openly.
Does Susan know at this stage, you know, do they move to one side so that Susan doesn't hear it? And would we get that across? ? I mean, it's part of me. No, I won't continue that thought at this time. We need to move on to the next scene because we'll only have time to do it. Scene two. Let's move on. So we have Green and Bradshaw initially, and then we are going to be introduced to two new characters as well, Black Will and Shakebag. I don't think we've met Bradshaw yet, but we've met Green. Who was Green? Alan was Green. Lovely. Eric, be Bradshaw. Sarah, you can be Black Will, and I'll be Shakebag. I don't think we can... I can avoid being in the scene, so let's see how that goes. I won't read any stage directions. There's only a few entrances and exits. We'll just let it run, I think, actually. We'll just give it his head of steam, unless I suddenly go, ooh, that's an interesting thought. I'm Shakebag, aren't I? Yes, I am. Okay, so enter Green and Bradshaw.
See you them that comes yonder, Master Green.
Aye, very well. Do you know them?
The one I know not, but he seems a knave, chiefly for bearing the other company. For such a slave, so vile a rogue as he, lives not again upon the earth. Black Will is his name. I tell you, Master Green, at Boulogne, he and I were fellow soldiers, where he played such pranks as all the camp feared him for his villainy. I warrant you, he bears so bad a mind that for a crown he'll murder any man.
The fitter is he for my purpose, marry.
How now, fellow Bradshaw? Whither away so early?
Oh, well, times have changed. No fellows now, though we were once together in the field, yet thy friend, to do thee any good I can.
Why, Bradshaw, was not thou and I fellow soldiers at Boulogne, where I was a corporal, and thou but a base mercenary groom? No fellows now, because you are a goldsmith and have a little plate in your shop. You were glad to call me fellow Will, and with a curtsy to the earth, one snatch good corporal, when I stole the half ox from John the Victualler, and domineered with it among good fellows in one night.
Aye, Will, those days are past with me.
Aye, but they are not past with me, for I keep that same honourable mind still. Good neighbour Bradshaw, you were too proud to be my fellow. But were it not that I see more company coming down the hill, I will be fellows with you once more, and share crowns with you too. But let that pass, and tell me whither you go.
To London, Will, about a piece of service, wherein haply thou mayest pleasure me.
What is it?
Of late Lord Cheney lost some plate, which one did bring and sold it at my shop, saying he served Sir Anthony Cook. A search was made, the plate was found with me, and I am bound to answer at the seas. Now Lord Cheney solemnly vows, if law will serve him, he'll hang me for his plate. Now I'm going to London upon hope to find fellow. Now, Will, I know thou art acquainted with such companions.
What manner of man was he?
A lean-faced, writhen knave, hawk-nosed and very hollow-eyed, with mighty furrows in his stormy brows, long hair down his shoulders curled. His chin was bare, but his upper lip a mustachio, which he wound about his ear.
What apparel had he?
Watchet satin doublet, all to torn. The inner side did bear the greater show. The pair of threadbare velvet hose seemed rent, worsted stocking rent above the shoe, a liveried cloak, but all the lace was off. 'Twas bad, but yet it served to hide the place.
Sirrah Shakeberg, canst thou remember, since we trolled the bowl at Sittingborough, where I broke the tapster's head of the lion with a cudgel stick?
Aye, very well, Will.
Why, it was with the money that the plate was sold for. Sirrah Bradshaw, what wilt thou give him that can tell thee who sold thy plate?
Who, I pray thee, Goodwill?
Why, 'twas one Jack Fitton. He's now in Newgate for stealing a horse, and shall be arraigned the next size.
Why, then, let Lord Cheney seek Jack Fitton forth, for I'll back and tell him who robbed him of his plate. This cheers my heart. Master Green, I'll leave you, for I must to the Isle of Sheppey with speed.
Before you go, let me entreat you to carry this letter to Mistress Arden of Faversham, and humbly recommend me to herself.
That will I, Master Green, and so farewell. Here, Will, there's a crown for thy good news.
Farewell, Bradshaw. I'll drink no water for thy sake while this lasts. Now, gentlemen, shall we have your company to London?
Nay, stay, sirs. A little more I needs must use your help. And in a matter of great consequence, wherein, if you'll be secret and profound, I'll give you 20 angels for your pains.
How, 20 angels? Give my fellow George Shakebad and me 20 angels? And if thou'lt have thy own father slain, that thou mayst inherit his land, we'll kill him.
Aye, thy mother, thy sister, thy brother, or all thy kin.
Well, this is it. Arden of Famishon hath highly wronged me about the Abbey land, that no revenge but death will serve the term. Will you two kill him? Here's the angels down, and I will lay the platform of his death.
Plat me no platforms. Give me the money and I'll stab him as he stands pissing against a wall, but I'll kill him.
Where is he?
He's now in London, in Aldersgate Street.
He's dead as if he had been condemned by an act of Parliament, if once Black Will and I swear his death.
Here is £10, and when he's dead, you shall have 20 more.
My fingers itches to be at the peasant. Oh, that I might be set a work thus through the year, and that murder would grow to an occupation that a man might follow without danger of law. Zounds, I warrant I should be warden of the company. Come, let us be going, and we'll bait at Rochester Well, I'll give thee a gallon of sack to handle the match withal.
And they exit. Okay, well, most of this is practically designed for audio. It's brilliant because you get two characters. Okay, we don't really know Bradshaw. Bradshaw is a sort of intermediary person for Green. Who's, you know, looking for a fence. So it's interesting. All sorts of questions I've got about Master Bradshaw. But it's great because Bradshaw, is basically there to say, oh, you see that person over there on the other side of the room? I'll tell you all about him. I'm only going to tell you about one of the people on the other side of the room so that the audience can take in the fact that we're talking about Will, Black Will. And then Shakebag is sort of drawn in later on. And again, that's really good for audio. It's not like we have two characters and we have to figure out who they are, the listening people at home. And basically, we just need pub sound effects. It's clearly one of those dodgy boozers where you can get a stolen car, Blu-ray players, and murder on tap. We've all walked into one of them boozers, haven't we? So many times. Actually, you don't really get this kind of pub that often anymore. Really, it's all gone a bit upmarket. It's such a shame. Sarah.
I actually used to live over a pub like that, but that's a different story.
Mm. Yes, I've got quite a few stories I don't think I want to broadcast.
Can I just shout and give a shout out for the greatness that is the description, Bradshaw's description of Jack Fitton, this lean faced writhen knave, who has a mustache which he winds about his ear, that is just amazing. And then we get into his clothes, and I just love the fact we get so much detail about a character who doesn't even appear. He's just like, I don't even know why this description is here, other than the fact it's brilliant and it lends itself really well to audio.
I have to say, I was spending a fair percentage of the thing going, okay, do we need the first half of this scene? If we were just going for economy and just wanted to get straight on with the plot, you'd have the introduction and he'd go over and say, would you do some murdering? And yet it is such a well, and it tells us exactly who Black Will and Shakebag are, the world that they're in, actually, because of this whole thing about, well, we stole some goods, we sent it to a fence. Do you know who the fence was? Oh, it's him. He's about to be hacked, you know, and my master and all this stuff, this underworld stuff. I worry it will be a bit impenetrable, actually, as audio, because it is so rich. But yeah, it is wonderful.
You can't cut it, though. I mean, I think, you've got to, obviously, it's got to be well directed. Your actor's got to bring it to life so the audience don't get lost in it. But you're right, it's not entirely relevant. You could cut it, but it would just be such a shame because it's just brilliant.
I think this is one of those scenes where basically you record it with a few more mentions of people's names just to make sure that we're... Because I say Bradshaw is not someone who gets his name said quite a lot, actually, but just to reiterate who everybody is a few times to just pepper them in. I think this is one where you decide in the edit. Basically, you record it all. And then you decide, actually listening back a few times, are you getting it? Is it coming across? Do we just get on with the plot? I mean, it's not a long scene. That's why it's, really nice. Once you get to the actual meat of the scene, the last, 50 lines, it's not even that, is it? It's a really short bit of action. Eric?
I just like that every character seems to have a backstory, like without actually like, it's unnecessary kind of, but like, it's kind of, because Green is coming into the scene to sort of find this, person who is basically a murderer. And it, like Bradshaw is the missing link, so to speak. And I just like that he has this sort of, not just because I read it, but it's just because he has this moment of like, Yeah, so I'm in trouble and I have to go to London where you're going to go, but I'm not going to ride with you because I have to, yeah. It's just, yeah. Fascinating. And but he also says I'm going to the Isle of Sheppey. I don't know if that was a pub or a place or something else.
And it's weird. I just the negotiating thing, because Green does not. I don't think he's offering the money that Alice gave him. He's not halving it and saying here's five and then another etc. will follow. He's weirdly honest about that. You know, I don't think he deals with the underworld very often. I mean, this is where Green's greenness is quite important, that he's got Bradshaw here. And you sort of think if this was a stage show as well, Bradshaw would be going, this guy, take him. So when you're talking about how enthusiastic they are for murdering, they're really keen on, oh, yeah, we'll kill anyone, mate. You kind of feel that it's all been set up a bit. Alan, then Sarah.
I must admit, I would resist cuts in this scene because I think it works. It's very short. It's building a world and building the backstories. And it engaged my interest throughout, which scene one, signally failed to do it, basically.
Sarah.
I found myself nodding off on occasion.
Yes, well, yeah, of course Green gives them all the money because he's chivalrous. He's a man of honour. He, you know, when days were old and nights were bold, you know, he's loving all that. I mean, he's probably terrified, actually. You know, he's probably presented. Bradshaw introduces him to these two massively unsavoury characters and he's probably like, oh, wow, I'm really living now. You know, meeting these people. I think he's just way, way out of his depth. And actually, I do love the idea of Bradshaw giving a bit of a nod and a wink to them, because because otherwise Bradshaw is a little bit of a weird character. It's like, yes, let me just shoehorn in this character to introduce this person to these people. So yeah, if he's kind of slightly in on it, that would be good.
Hmm. I was wondering, I'll say it again, I haven't double-checked my doubling chart. So Bradshaw's a goldsmith. I'm not sure, does he turn up again? I'm not sure he does. He might do. Yes, he does. He does. Yes, quite. He's again. He's about. So Bradshaw is another one of these minor characters, but who is really, really well-developed. And that's what's really nice. Everyone here, you've got a sense of who they are. And I say, I've got a very clear idea how to tell an actor to play Green. I think Bradshaw is more respectable, but he's got his foot in this world because, you know, he wants to know, you know, who's nicking stuff and selling it, and you know, and he's probably taking a cut. I love the way Green, you know, before you go, let me entreat you to carry this letter to Mistress Arden of Feathersham and humbly recommend me to herself. And it's just like, oh, bless. Is this the time to play? He's so earnest. He's so earnest. but yeah, I was very worried that he was going to pay everything up front as well. He was just going to hand them all the money. So I was quite pleased. Though, doesn't he say, here is £10, and when he is dead, you shall have 20 more? We said at the beginning, I'll give you 20 angels for your pains. So I'm sort of thinking, you know, oh, well, never mind. He could have. They were quite happy for 20 angels. So you know, he's lost out on that one. Eric.
Well, he never. Maybe he doesn't do bargaining very well.
I don't think he does.
I think it's interesting because this scene kind of it's the transition into the world of London and stuff. But it kind of also feels like Green has stepped in from a different place. Sort of, you know, he's totally, you know, the knight in the burning pestle, or which is much later than this, obviously, but he's totally in his head.
Like, I think of. He more climb on Climades. He's one of those valiant knights. He's in a much more earnest drama.
Definitely. And he just meets these characters going, shit, what do I do? I offer them money for this. It's like murder is beneath me, but I must save this lady and I must have my lands kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if any of you have gone into a pub and commissioned anybody's murder. I mean, it's really, really, it's, you know, you get nervous, you know, get a bit sweat, you know. I just to clarify, I am kidding there. Sarah.
I forgot what I was going to say now. Oh, yeah.
It was so intense that Sarah's frozen.
He's got a bit of
Sorry, Sarah, you froze. You said you'd forgotten what you were going to say, and then you froze dramatically on the screen. You've frozen again, I think.
Hello?
Hello, okay. Yes.
Hello, am I back?
You are back, yes.
Sorry about that. Yes, going back to the character of Bradshaw, he's got a bit of a used car salesman quality to him. It's like, because I thought all that business about the story of Lord Cheney's, you know, loss and plate was quite revealing as well, because you know, someone brought it into his shop and saying that he served Sir Anthony Cook, and you know, oh, I've just got this plate to sell. So you get the impression that he's probably running quite a high class establishment in terms of, oh, look, I have this beautiful plate to sell. But he's not that picky about where it comes from. You know, because there's that thing of, yeah, oh yeah, one came in and said he served Sir Anthony Cook and turned out to be Lord Cheney's plate, and now I'm on the hook for it. But it's like, yeah, if he'd actually gone into any depth about where this plate had actually come from, he wouldn't have taken it in the first place, you know, if he was an honest trader. So he has this kind of veneer of, you know, respectability to him, but he's clearly not averse to you know, receiving stolen goods or not asking too many questions about where they came from.
Yeah, and of course, you know, their connection, they give us character connections. You know, they know each other because they're all in the army together, and you know, that's why they know each other. And it's all this stuff about fellow and how you address me. So it's like this is a goldsmith who's, you know, he's made his way from, you know, humble apprentice or whatever he was, presumably when, you know, he came back from, or before he went to war, however that thing functioned. And so his mates have remained down in the underworld, and he's sort of become a bit respectable. But, you know, it's like that thing from Breaking Bad, you know, you need a criminal lawyer, and, you know, with the emphasis on you need a criminal lawyer. And it's that sort of thing. And again, yeah, it's just such a wonderful world. You just need someone who can really inhabit the characters of Will, I think, is the one. And here we have it. He's called Black Will. And there's the second character in this play who, for a question of race, may arise. Because in the source material, we also have this constant references to Mosby. As being, I think he's described as being a black swart man. Black Will is known as Black Will. That might be because of, just straightforwardly, because of, you know, his black deeds. But there's something dancing around this text, and certainly in terms of casting, that might be a decision to be made as to that, though. I don't know on that point at the moment. But there does seem to be something dancing around about the associations with blackness in this text. Mm. And that's something that needs to be addressed before going into it, because if they're constantly talking about Black Will, a line needs to be taken on that. And see where that goes. Eric?
Well, because also we've been talking about this sort of text being for audio, we haven't really mentioned the obvious, which is kind of like the exchange of monies moving, like, sort of, you know, when you hand over money, I guess it would make a sound, like sort of jingling coins or...
Oh, yes, I have been noticing SFX clink a few times in my scripts as we've been going along of different amounts as well. So yeah, absolutely. And also just the placing of, here's a crown for thy good news. So that's more a thunk rather than a, because it's only one. rather than a bag of angels, which is how that would work. So I'm just typing that in as I'm speaking. Money bag. I've got several money bags with different metal objects in them of different sizes, depending on the kind of money being passed. Okay. I'm going to say we're not going to attack scene three this session. It was always a bit of a tall order to do scene three because, though most of the time only about three or four people talk at the same time, there is a slightly fiddly bit in the middle of it where people exit, people enter, people exit, people enter, and it might be easier to have at least one more person in the room before we do that. But we are creeping ever so slowly. But I say, we're not in a hurry. Not in a hurry at all. We're nearly a third of the way through the text. That's all right. Any final thoughts on the room before I close the session? So far, this is not presenting me with any terrors in terms of turning it into audio. I think it's primarily based around a relatively tight core company who have most of the work. It's irritating that you can't downsize it too much. I mean, I'm looking at it going, I could potentially cut Susan as an actual speaking part. If necessary, I don't particularly want to do that. I'm usually averse to removing female characters of whom there are so often so few. She's certainly present later on, and that may create complications, but I'm going to raise that as a possibility. The nature, or more importantly, the doubling that is potentially possible there. But at the moment, I still can't really get this cast down to less than 12 with sensible doubling. And as I say, in an audio universe, I tend to try and avoid doubling as much as possible because it doesn't usually work very effectively. Any other final thoughts on these first two scenes? Otherwise, I will close the session. Right, that's it then for killing Arden. We will continue trying to kill him, and we're going to keep trying to kill him for quite a long time. I think it's going to take at least three, maybe four sessions before we actually get to the murder. So, you know, hang on in there. Arden, as I say, the opera treatment once memorably called the play, Arden must die. All that remains to thank the wonderful readers, Alan, Eric and Sarah, for their wonderful reading. Thank you very much, everyone, and goodbye. I'll stab him as he stands pissing against a wall.